Much like sports for able-bodied participants, adaptive sports have their own unique barriers, injuries, and concerns. And joining me today to discuss adaptive sports are Dr. Andrew Hills and Dr. Benan Ong, both of whom work with adaptive sports athletes to help treat injuries and more. This is the Franciscan Health Doc Pod. I'm Scott Webb. It's great to have you both here today. We're going to talk through how to care for athletes who participate in adaptive sports and exactly what does that mean, adaptive sports. And I was telling Dr. Hills, I have a little bit of experience. My daughter refereed an adaptive sports PE basketball game and the whole school was there and it was very cool, but I'm definitely not an expert. You guys are. So I'll start with you, Dr. Hills. What are adaptive sports?
They're kind of like our sports for able-bodied people, but like the term adaptive, kind of modifying the sport to promote inclusion for individuals with disability. Because the main goal here is we want everybody to be able to participate in the sport if they want to. It really promotes that inclusion, physical fitness, and improves everyone's quality of life when they participate. So these sports are modified by rule changes. We add certain equipment or we change how the rules of the sport to kind of change how it's overall played. Like our typical sports, these organizations can be played at a variety of levels, similar to adaptive PE class. It can range from anywhere from like recreational league to something very competitive. We know we recently just had the Olympics, so I mean, it can get all the way to the point where you're participating internationally in the Paralympic Games. And it's something that's really grown over the last few decades. It kind of all started, I would say, in England. They've always had a historic push for adaptive sports. They're the ones that first allowed it to be part of the Olympic Games. It started in 1948 in London. Olympics, they had 16 patients who were World War II veterans at that time with spinal cord injuries. But then it took a whole nother turn when London hosted the Olympic Games again in 2012, because then they had 4,000 adaptive athletes at Wow. those Paralympic Games. So it's crazy how much adaptive sports have grown over the years.
All right, so we get a sense there of what it is exactly or what they are and, you know, how much they've grown. Dr. Ong, are there still, though, some barriers of getting into adaptive sports?
Let me give you guys a little context. You know, I'm a rehabilitation doctor, so my job very often is to work alongside orthopedic surgeons, neurologists, any other specialty that's taking care of a disease. And my job is to try to maximize their function, both, you know, inside the home in their day-to-day lives, as well as trying to get them back into the community. And so when we're talking about adaptive sports, a lot of the barriers to getting into adaptive sports comes first from getting them comfortable, you know, in their day-to-day life, and then kind of moving out from there. Okay. So, you know, I'll give a few examples here, but, you know, if we have someone like that's an amputee, for instance, right, they may be dealing with things like phantom pain. Their prosthesis may not fit well. They may not have been trained on how to drive with their prosthesis. You know, maybe there's mental health issues about self-consciousness about how they look with their prosthesis. If they were involved in an accident, you know, maybe they have some PTSD issues from the accident that lost, you know, their limb. Yeah. Or if we take another condition like, you know, strokes, spinal cord injuries, brain injuries, which I kind of have a subspecialty in. You know, that population may have difficulty feeding themselves, managing their bowel and bladder. And so if they're not comfortable with those conditions and managing them, they're not going to want to leave the home to go to a sports event and participate with other people. And, you know, even if they are comfortable in their home life, there's a lot of unique problems of getting outside the house, right? So how do you transport a wheelchair or a power chair, especially that, you know, may weigh a couple hundred pounds.
Right.
Or if they have a wheelchair, can that wheelchair get through the sand to get down to a beach so they can do some adaptive kayaking? Hmm. Can it get through some wooded areas if they want to get back into adaptive hunting? There might be special equipment needs and stuff that they'll have to navigate to participate. And, you know, some of this, I will mention this because it comes up a lot. A lot of people get put off because they're like, well, I want to do this or that, but I need this equipment and, you know, I'm not working. I'm on fixed income. because I have all these problems. And there are resources to help people with that, you know, and
sure.
Dr. Hills and I are familiar with those resources, whether it be grant programs or equipment that might be better suited, you know, at certain budget levels and you know, things like that.
Right.
So sometimes the big barrier isn't necessarily the condition that the patient has, but really just never being hooked up with the resources and being given the exposure to adaptive sports and, you know, how to make that happen.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting, right? So there's some obvious, perhaps physical barriers, maybe some mental barriers, you're saying financial and otherwise, just folks knowing about these things, being connected with the right resources. Wondering, Dr. Hills, are there some unique risks or injuries, like these unique sort of forces and mechanisms of injury in different sports, whether we're talking wheelchair sports, joint laxity, overuse, residual limb sores? I have a whole list here.
Yeah.
Just wondering if you can talk through some of this for us.
And I would say, like, similar to or more like able-bodied sports, you know, injuries are somewhat unique based off the sport that's being played. So it is somewhat of a broad topic.
Sure.
I would say there is maybe a slight trend, maybe more towards the overuse injuries as a para athlete, just as Dr. Ong's kind of talking about some of those additional like physical barriers they have to come from transportation. You're reliant on, like if you're an amputee, you're reliant more maybe on your upper body. Therefore, you're putting more stresses across those joints. If you're participating in wheelchair basketball, you know, it's predominantly controlling the wheelchair with your upper extremities, your arms there. So again, you're putting a lot of additional stresses across that shoulder. Hmm. Whereas someone who is able to use both their arms and legs, they can kind of dissipate those forces across their joints. So, you know, there does tend to be a little bit more overuse injuries in adaptive sports. But again, the sport definitely does matter. So, you know, I mentioned wheelchair basketball, and when you get to some of these more competitive leagues, it's very much a like contact sport.
Right.
You know, they're ramming into each other, they're tipping over, there's risk for fractures and concussions. Similar, you know, we got our first snow here recently. So, you know, our adaptive sports from our winter standpoint, you know, they're adding a lot more speed and potential for impact with these like adaptive skiing, which again brings in the increased risk of fractures and concussions. So overall, definitely more, I'd say, overuse, but at the same time, we definitely still see the acute injuries depending on the sport.
Yeah, I've watched some wheelchair basketball, you know, like, so I mentioned my daughter's a basketball player, and for her, especially being an outside shooter much of the time, you know, it's all about her legs, you know, and building up her leg strength and being able to jump over defenders and shoot over them. And then I've watched wheelchair basketball and thought, how do they do that? Their arms must be so strong. And then, as you say, really all levels of basketball are contact sports, whether people realize it or not. But especially in wheelchairs, I've seen a lot of that ramming into each other, knocking each other over. It's pretty violent. It's fun to watch, and I'm sure it's fun for them to participate. But as you say, there can be some injuries, right?
Exactly. 100%.
Yeah. Dr. Ong, I want to have you talk through things like osteoporosis, autonomic dysreflexia, pressure ulcers, plasticity, those types of things from your perspective.
You know, Dr. Hills mentioned that there's a lot of unique forces on a patient, you know, depending on the sport that they're playing. But depending on their disease, you know, whatever is causing their disability, they might be at kind of increased risk to have certain problems compared to a normal athlete.
Sure.
So if you have someone who, for instance, is maybe a paraplegic, who maybe hasn't walked, you know, in a year or more, who uses a wheelchair to get around, their bones can develop osteoporosis, right? They become brittle and soft. And so things that normally wouldn't cause a fracture to an able-bodied person will cause a fracture, right? If you catch an arm on a jersey and it twists your arm, you know, just a little bit too hard, or if you tip out of your wheelchair, you know, that fall may only be 1 or 2 feet or something like that. But it, for someone that has brittle bones, right, that alone can cause fractures.
Yeah.
And so when you're clearing people for sports, right, like most regular sports physicals don't include a bone density scan to check on things like that, right?
Right.
To know what your risk is and maybe get it treated before you participate in the sport. there are kind of other global symptoms that have similar implications, right? So people that have a lot of numbness, for instance, right, may not be able to feel their skin. They may be in bed a lot of time. They may have wounds, that like bed sores and stuff like that. So when you take these patients and you put them into a sporting event where there's now more friction, more pressure and stuff like that, it may increase their risk of developing sores or worsen ones that they already have. So there might be unique considerations that have to take place about, you know, how do you pad this or that? How do you maybe modify what they do to distribute the forces differently? I would say those are kind of some unique things. And then in terms of competitive sports, you know, there are a lot of conditions that can cause involuntary muscle movements, sure, right? Or joint contractures where your arm can't, you know, fully bend or straighten and things like that. And so if you're really trying to compete at a competitive level and you're trying to do like a throwing sport or something like that, you're not going to be able to throw in the most optimal manner, right? And that can limit your competitive edge. And so doctors like, you know, Dr. Hills and I, you know, we're trying to find ways to overcome each of these unique barriers and how to normalize people's body mechanics and function as much as possible.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Wondering, Dr. Hills, how does sports med and PM&R optimize performance and prevent injury? You know, specifically when it comes to tailoring those treatments to disease-specific deficits.
I think that's one of the big things I like to emphasize, especially in this population. You know, we're throwing out the term like adaptive.
Right.
And for me, from like a medicine, like foundational standpoint, not a whole lot actually in my mind kind of changed. Yes, there are some unique aspects, but for me, the key thing, no matter if you're an adaptive athlete or any patient I'm seeing in the office, prevention is really the first place we need to focus on. Because if we can prevent the injury from even happening, that's the key thing.
Yeah.
Especially in this population, because if you do have an injury, you know, they already have these impairments. So adding an additional injury to it can definitely change not only their quality of life, but just being able to independently complete their activities of daily living. So we've been talking a lot about, like, you know, wheelchair basketball and things like that. So people who are dependent on a wheelchair, we definitely want to optimize their positioning in the chair to decrease that increased forces across that shoulder joint. So one example, we do that. So, you know, we do place the rear axle of the chair kind of slightly behind the athlete's center of gravity. It does allow the athlete to have a little bit better grasp and propulsion, just to kind of make mechanics a little bit more efficient there. The wheelchairs have more of an angle to it. So
yeah,
at the base, it's wider, and then it's a little bit more narrow at the top. There's a medical or biomechanical term. It's called camber, which again, increases kind of the responsiveness to their hands in regards to turning, provides better stability. And again, as we've been mentioning with the contact aspect, you know, it does allow your opponent not to be able to get as close to you, which is kind of nice from that standpoint.
Yeah.
And then some of the unique things with amputees is really making a big focus on how does their prosthetic fit. It truly needs to be a snug and perfect fit. Any movement at the skin where that prosthetic is kind of meeting the skin can result in increased pain, blisters, open wound, if there's any extra movement. And we do need to be flexible though, as they're participating, because, you know, as we're sweating and, you know, their limb can actually change shape as the competition's kind of moving along. Right. So we got to be flexible and be able to kind of adapt to those more moist environments as they're kind of in the middle of the competition. They may need to add a extra layer or sock to their limb to kind of recreate that kind of snug fit throughout the competition to, again, to prevent some of that extra movement, to prevent injury in the first place. And for me, you know, that's the key thing, especially in this population, is it's all about preventing the injury before it happens.
Right. Certainly you can treat the injuries after they happen, but in a perfect world, ideally, we're preventing them as much as possible. So I'm sure education is key. Dr. Ong mentioned earlier having the proper resources, or the amount of resources, of course. Dr. Ong, wondering what a multidisciplinary approach looks like when we think about sports medicine specialists and a physical medicine physician, you know, working together, a part of that team. How does that work?
You know, there's a lot of overlap between, you know, what I do, what Dr. Hills does, and honestly, with a lot of other specialties as well. It requires a lot of coordination to kind of get patients to function at their best in all settings. You know, I kind of mentioned earlier about how patients function inside the home and things like that, right? So, you know, when Dr. Hills and I, you know, work together, I kind of focus on a lot of those barriers, you know, to get patients out to the sport, right? Yeah. Can they get dressed? Can they get in a car? Can they drive? Are their medical issues kind of optimized to participate in this sport? Then Dr. Hills can kind of take over if there's sports-specific injuries, and, you know, we can always collaborate as well.
Yeah.
If there's special equipment that a patient needs, right, it kind of has to take into consideration what those needs are inside the home and what those needs are in that specific sport.
Right.
Likewise, sometimes if a patient has a sports injury, that injury may carry over into how they're going to function at home. If they fracture a leg, yes, they can't participate in a sport, but how are they going to get out of bed and get in their wheelchair and get downstairs or things like that, right?
Right.
It all ties together. I think, you know, patients are best served if they have multiple doctors kind of paying attention to all these various things.
So I'm going to finish up with you, Dr. Hills. Talk through, I want to understand the Special Olympics and Paralympics. Like, are those the same things, or are they sort of the same, somewhere in the middle? Are those the same things, or are there some differences?
You said kind of somewhere in the middle. I like that answer. In general, I mean, both of them are important, and they both have similar missions. They want to promote that inclusion and provide physical fitness opportunities for individuals with impairments that affect their daily life. There is a difference between the two, though. Special Olympics, it does tend to be a little bit more focused on individuals who have intellectual impairments, okay, where you see more of the Paralympics. It's traditionally focused more on the physical impairments. But again, that's why I like to say, you know, with your questioning, it's kind of somewhere in the middle, because right, if you actually look at the Paralympics, they actually have certified raters for your impairment, and they divide your impairment into 10 different categories. And 8 of those 10 categories are actual physical impairments, but they do, one of the 10 does include an intellectual component to it. So there definitely is some overlap between the two. So mostly it's an oversimplification, but Special Olympics does tend to be a little bit more intellectual impairments, whereas Paralympics does a little bit more physical.
Yeah, good to understand. They're different, but there is some overlap. There is some, you know, meeting in the middle a little bit. This has been really good stuff today, really educational. I just want to thank you both for your time. These are the ones that are, for me, you know, I get to a certain age in my 50s and I think I probably know everything now, right? And then I talk to a couple experts, multidisciplinary teammates, if you will, and I go, you know what? There's so much I don't know. So that's why it's great to have experts, have you on. So thank you both.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
And to learn more about Dr. Andrew Hills or Dr. Benan Ong, visit franciscanhealth.org and type their name into the search bar. And if you found this podcast helpful, please share it on your social channels and be sure to check out the full podcast library for additional topics of interest. This is the Franciscan Health Doc Pod. I'm Scott Webb. Stay well, and we'll talk again next time.